Session number 12778.
General Martin, Rear 17.
And the crowds were then marched down to Lo Wu, to the station there, and then along the banks of the river to Shumchun River to Mangkhan To, before returning back to Shumchun. During one such march, I phoned my opposite number in the police, the Assistant Commissioner of Police New Territories, and asked him what he would do if one Saturday the crowd, instead of stopping at Lo Wu, were to come marching on across into New Territories. He said that in his opinion this would be a case of external aggression and would be up to the army to deal with. I said that, in my opinion, it would be a case of unlawful assembly and would be up to the police to deal with. And the upshot was that we got a government ruling that it would be the task of the police initially to attempt to stop the crowd on the border, but that the army would simultaneously erect a stop line some half a mile or so to the rear of the border, and here the crowd would be held if the police couldn't do anything about it, and would be dispersed back again over the border by joint military-police action. And it was fairly obvious to me that if this plan ever had to be adopted, and we had to use force to disperse a crowd back to their own side of the border, we might become actively engaged with the Chinese army. And who knew what that would lead to. So I started a scheme called Wappenshaw, after some extraordinary Scottish practice of standing to for various eventualities. And under Wappenshaw, whenever there was a demonstration on the Chinese side of the border, the Frontier Battalion immediately deployed to its blocking positions, equipped not only for an internal security drill, but for war as well. And on such occasions, the medium guns of 18 Light Regiment would deploy on the airstrip at Sakong with their muzzles pointing up towards the border, which they could hit very easily from that range if ever anything got as desperate as that. Now, on the 28th of June 1967, we knew that there was going to be a demonstration by our own villagers at Chateau Cock, and that they intended to try and pull down the Union Jack from the police station in the village to show their solidarity with their brothers the other side of the border. It was the task of our police to stop this happening, but I deployed the Frontier Battalion on the stop line, in fact about a mile and a half in rear of the Chateau Cock, at a major police station, just in case. And what happened was that while the police were blocking the road leading from what was called the Rural Committee building near the police station, to prevent the crowd actually reaching the police station and pulling down the Union Jack, a mob of about 200 rushed across from Chinese territory, damaged some police vehicles, and attempted to break into the police station. And the crowd was dispersed by the police with gas and wooden batten shells, and a number of rioters from China were hurt. And we knew straight away that there would be an attempt at vengeance. And in due course, we heard that this was to take place on Saturday, the 8th of July. By 10 a.m. That morning, the 8th of July, the police had two companies, about 140 men in all, up in Chateau Cock village, with a third company in reserve a short way to the rear. I had got a company of the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles on the stop line, a mile and a half in the rear of the village, and my own brigade headquarters, tactical headquarters, I moved down and set up alongside the Assistant Commissioner, set up at Fanling Police Station, which was the headquarters of the Police Frontier Division. So we were having a meeting in this police station with the head of the Police Frontier Division, myself, and the District Commissioner of New Territories, when about 10 o'clock that morning we were told that 500 Chinese soldiers had just arrived in Shattuck Kok. I asked a special branch chap who was at the meeting what his assessment was of this 500 arrival of 500 soldiers, and he said he thought they had come to prevent militant civilians from China from coming across into British territory. And he was in fact talking to us at that moment when Chaplain Richardson, when the brigade duty officer rushed in to say that Shattuck Kok police station was under heavy machine gun fire. Well, after the previous riot, I had asked the Commander of British Forces to take up with the government, Hong Kong government, what I should do with the army should there be a really serious attack on Shattuck Kok police station following the abortive one on 24th June. And the reply which I got was that on no account was the army to get involved in Shattuck Kok, because if it did so, it would almost inevitably lead to a shooting match with the Chinese army. So when the shooting started in Shattuck Kok village that morning, I really could do nothing except order the whole of the 1st 10th Gurkhan Rifles up to the stop line, warn them that I thought they might have the task of having to rescue the police, but they were on no account to move until further orders. And I sat at the Fanling police station listening to a running commentary from Shattuck Kok police station, which was getting more and more hysterical the whole time. What had happened was that the demonstration had formed up on our own side of the border, as it had on the 24th of June, but as the police were ordering the mob to disperse, the reserve police company moved up to the village also and debussed. And there it was, forming up on the road outside the police station, when there was a burst of machine gun fire from the Chinese side of the border. Two policemen were killed and another number of others seriously wounded. Armed men then came rushing across from the Chinese side of the border and laid siege to the police station and the Rural Committee building where the other policemen had held up. The police had come equipped principally for riot duties, and out of 320 policemen in Shattuck Kok, only 30 had rifles. And so the remainder were, morale was not high. The police station was a sort of beau geste type of police station, with a few slits in the walls to stick a rifle through. But the first two policemen to take up position in the slits got shot instantly and were shot dead. And the rest, who were therefore sort of inside this claustrophobic police station, unable to see out, unable to get out, with people trying to blow the doors of the police station open with gelignite, were shouting, "Help, help, help, we want the army." And eventually at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the police were told to evacuate Shattuck Kok completely, and that this was preferable to getting the army involved there. However, they couldn't get out because of all the firing. And so eventually at 3:30, I was ordered to send a force in to relieve them. Well, at that stage, therefore, we had 1st-10th Gurkha rifles with a troop of lifeguards under command, a mile and a half in rear Shattercock, and ready to go. And all I did was I spoke to the CO on the radio, Ronnie McAllister, a very, very good commanding officer, and I told him his tasks were to secure Shattercock village up to the line of the border with a view to getting life back to normal in the village as quickly as possible, and having secured the village, to evacuate the police from it. I had to give him clear orders about opening fire, and that was obviously a difficult one. A policeman had been killed and wounded by a small arms fire from both sides of the border, and it was anybody's guess what was going to happen as we started advancing on Shattercock. However, I was quite clear in my own mind that if we were ever to get conditions back to normal in Shattercock again, we've got to try and avoid killing Chinese nationals, whether civilians or soldiers. And I therefore told Ronnie McAllister that he was to obey the principle of minimum force and shoot back only in self-defence when fire against him was effective. Although, of course, if there was a full-blooded attack on him, he could then treat the situation as one of war. So with those rather nebulous orders, off went the 1st-10th Gurkha rifles. And they advanced astride the main road down towards Shattercock with two companies, one on either side of the road, and the troop of armoured cars, the lifeguards, travelling down the main road level with the leading companies. I flew over Shattercock in my helicopter, and I could see that the attack was still going on the police station. And about 4 o'clock, the Gurkhas were advancing on foot. I landed about 400 yards behind the leading companies to have a word with the CO, see how we were getting on. I could hear firing going on from the village, but so far there had been no interference with our movement forward. And I spoke to the commanding officer and said, I think you can get on a bit faster. And I walked forward to the leading armoured car, which was by this time about 700 yards from the village, and suddenly all hell was let loose in the shape of a heavy machine gun and a number of light machine guns which were firing straight down the road at us. And I leapt behind the armoured car, and I heard the driver of the armoured car, who had his head out of the turret at that time, say, effing hell, and slam the turret. But the bullets were bouncing off the armour like peas. And that went on for about 5 minutes. And as we later realised, it was covering fire from the Chinese army to cover the retirement of their own militia and so on back across the border before we could round them up. Well, we got cracking again, and A company of the 1st-10th displayed super field craft and was soon into the village. And by 4:30 there were soldiers on all the rooftops. The village was secure, and we started to evacuate this thoroughly demoralised police contingent. The tension in the village was electric. And we had armed Gurkha soldiers facing armed Chinese soldiers only 15 or 20 yards away. And one trigger-happy soldier on either side could have sparked an immediate battle. Civilians on both sides had shuttered themselves inside their houses. None were to be seen. I imposed a curfew on the village for the night on our side, and to mark the end of the curfew the following morning and try and, as I hoped, relieve tension a bit, I got the pipes and drums of the first six Gurkha rifles up to Beat Ravelli in the village street. And hardly had they finished than the entire population on both sides of the border streamed off for safety. I'm sure it was nothing to do with the playing of the first six Gurkha rifles, but it was taken as a far but from peaceable sign. During that day, I relieved the 1st 10th with the 1st 7th Gurkha Rifles because I felt that after their success in killing a number of our policemen at Shattuck, the communists on other parts of the border would want to have a go as well. This is all in support of their press comrades downtown and so on. And the 1st 10th, as the Frontier Battalion, knew slightly more about the border than any of the other battalions, which had been previously allocated only to Kowloon and Hong Kong City. So I relieved the 1st 10th, and I thought the next attack would probably come at Lo Wu, the main international crossing point, and so I put a company of the 1st 10th on a hill called Sandy Ridge, just to the rear of Lo Wu Station, out of sight, but ready to intervene if necessary. In Shattuck that night, a patrol of the 1st 7th had a bomb thrown at it from the Chinese side of the main street, and one soldier was slightly injured. And I thought we had to do something about this. And the question was, what? Well, the Chinese had been making continual use of loudspeakers all along the border for some time to put across propaganda to the villagers living on our side. And I decided, therefore, that we would launch loudspeaker attacks as well. And so I got the Government Information Service to send up a very powerful loudspeaker to Shattuck. And we then did a broadcast, and I felt that the best tactics were to pretend that the Chinese army didn't approve of the action of the militia. And so I got the command of the 1st 7th to broadcast a message as from the commander of the British troops in Shattuck, so the commander of the Chinese troops in Shattuck, asking for his cooperation, ensuring that there were no incidents which might lead to bloodshed. You can't really just talk to Chinese like that, saying please stop any incidents which will lead to bloodshed. You have to dress up your thing in the thoughts of, or you had in those days, in the thoughts of Chairman Mao. So our message said that to the Chinese commander, told him of the bomb incident, which we were certain he did not approve of, and said that in accordance with the thoughts of Chairman Mao, we wouldn't harm anyone first, but if anybody hurt us in future, we would hurt them back. We repeated the message twice. The Chinese commander himself came down and to quite close to the border and wrote it down in his notebook. And that seemed, things were kept fairly quiet in Shattuck for a day or two. But we had broadcast in Cantonese, and clearly after a few days the locals on the other side of the border got at the army and told them they were taking orders from the British. And once we realised that the army itself was in some difficulties over keeping control, we changed to Mandarin, which is the dialect understood by the Chinese, by the professional classes in China, including the army, but not normally by the villagers. And this again was effective for a time, but again, after time, the Chinese over on the other side of Shattuck were clearly getting at the army for being so wet. In the end, we did find a very good way of communicating with the Chinese army, but I'll explain that later. Meanwhile, on the evening of the 12th of July, that's 4 days after the Shadycot massacre, the British police at Lo Wu went forward onto the railway bridge there at 5 p.m, as was their custom, to close the barrier on the bridge for the night, as there were going to be no more trains. As they approached the bridge, they were showered with stones and rocks by a crowd of about 200 men and youths, and beat a hasty retreat. The opposition then disappeared, but it came back as dusk was falling, armed to the teeth with rifles and light machine guns, and proceeded to take up positions on the Chinese side of the river bank beside the bridge. The Hong Kong police reported they thought an attack was about to be made on their police post, and so I ordered the company of the 1st 10th Gurkhan Rifles, who were in position just behind Lo Wu, to move forward in up to the bridge, and I sent a troop of armoured cars forward to provide some illumination in their spotlights. The company, on its way forward to the bridge, met the police in full flight going the other way, and one can't blame them after what happened to Shattercock. But no attack materialised. But the company was then in occupation of the police of the station buildings, and it was going to remain there for a good long time. Well, it seemed to me that following the Shattercock battle, which was regarded as a great victory by the Communist Chinese, as we knew from all their propaganda broadcasts and from Radio Macau and Radio Canton and so on, we knew perfectly well we could expect further attacks against police posts all along the border. And I then got permission for the army to take over the security of the border from the police. I kept the police up with the army because I didn't want the opposition to be able to boast they'd driven the police away, and because the police had the expert knowledge of both the ground and of the actual people who came across to work on our side of the border. But having taken over the security of the border, the next question was what we were going to do. And I asked for a clear statement of government policy, but this wasn't forthcoming, and didn't come for another 6 months. But I cornered the acting political advisor. The political advisor himself was away, who told me that the government was just keeping its fingers crossed that somehow we would be able to maintain the border intact without at the same time getting involved in a war, and who emphasised the effect of any incidents on the border on confidence in Hong Kong. I also turned for advice to the psychological ops people who had come out from England, and their advice was that we should do all we could to prevent the escalation of force on the other side of the border, and we could best achieve this by carrying out our duties on the border in a ceremonial rather than operational manner. They said that if we erected sandbag emplacements and dug ourselves in, the Chinese would do the same, but that they had far greater forces available to them, and that the arrival of large bodies of Chinese soldiers on the border itself would have a disastrous effect on the local population of Hong Kong and would play still further into the hands of the Chinese communists in Kowloon, who were already claiming that the Chinese army was going to invade at any moment. The other thing I was able to do at this stage was to get clear direction on the circumstances in which my soldiers could open fire. And the rules laid down were as follows. If fired at from British territory, we could retaliate immediately by opening fire ourselves. If fired at from Chinese territory, we should not retaliate unless the fire was effective. And no clear definition of effective was given, but we understood it to mean unless people were actually getting hit by bullets. If we had to retaliate, we must do so with the same type of weapon that was being used against us. Then only if we could identify where the fire was coming from. So that meant that if fire against us was effective, we could answer rifles with rifles, machine guns with machine guns, but there was a proviso, we couldn't answer mortars or artillery with mortars and artillery without the prior consent of government, except in the situation of gravest emergency. So we now stood back and waited to see what would happen next, only too aware that the initiative lay entirely with the opposition. In Shattercock, the 1st 7th Gurkha Rifles were doing great work to restore confidence, and the people on both sides of the border began to trickle back again into their homes, shops opened, the post office opened, the clinic opened, and the fish market opened. And the remainder of July passed quietly except for stone throwing. Stone throwing is a very nasty thing to compete with. One's natural instinct is to throw stones back, but if you do so, you find that the stone throwers almost inevitably include children who you hit, and there's then a ghastly outcry. But it is extreme. I went on to the bridge at Lao Wu one day trying to stop or encourage the Chinese army of sentries at the other end to stop the stoning. And instead he waved a bunch of stone throwers onto the bridge, and I had my watch shattered, and it made one very, very angry. But they advanced from stone throwing to catapults. And the catapults they used were metal slugs and ball bearings, and they really got quite expert in that. And then they went on to air guns, air rifles, and metal slugs. So all we could do was work hard to make this form of activity less amusing for them by building up walls, first of all of sandbags and then of concrete behind them, to give some protection to soldiers in the forward posts. But this we did only where we were actually being assaulted with stones, air gun pellets, and catapults. The Chinese soldiers of 30 Border Regiment made not the slightest effort either at Lao Wu or Mankato to stop the stone throwers, and frequently encouraged them. And August arrived, and although we didn't know it, we were about to be involved in what we were to call later the Battles of Provocation by Poster. 800 members of the Chinese militia had just arrived back on the border from a fortnight's intensive training and were waiting, just waiting, for an excuse to test their skills on us.